Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. Go on ahead and use it. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think that you are a hater. Coming up, we've got Buzz Bissinger, the author of Friday Night Lights, to wrap up the Right Time Book Club. We've got some interesting thoughts on guys holding out and guys who are playing and acting like they're holding out. And, of course, you know, LeBron not competing for a championship. But first, Tiger Woods won a tournament. It is interesting to note that it's an important tournament, the Tour Championship. That is a big deal, but it's still a tournament. It is not a major. This is not, you know, what we grew up with as it related to Tiger Woods and what we expect. Because, look, he had to change his standard. His standard before was, you know, all about majors. He ain't won a major in like 10 years. Suddenly you have to reevaluate that, because otherwise that means your whole existence has been useless for 10 years. So no, it was not anymore. It's not so much about winning majors for Tiger. Like, the dude won the tour championship. The putt goes down and we saw him cry. I don't have any recollection of ever seeing Tiger Woods cry before, but there he was, because hey man, it's been a long time. It's been 5 years since he won a tournament. And it is worth noting that the last major he won was the 2008 U.S. Open, when he won it on the broken leg against Rocco Media. The next year, the PGA Championship, that's the Wai Yang year, and Wai Yang wound up getting him in the final round. And if you remember, Wai Yang picked up his bag because he was so excited, and Tiger looked like he wanted to punch him in the face. And it's been a long time since he'd been there. But 2013, he was still the best golfer in the world. Like, it's not as though, as much as we talk about the grand fall of Tiger Woods, no, what he had was a really embarrassing situation at first, right? The thing that happened with him and, you know, the driveway, the golf club and the window, like all that stuff. I mean, that was really, really embarrassing. But there's no like grand evidence that turned him into some totally different golfer. Physically, I thought the biggest issue was, hey man, broke his leg and everything that came from that. And then the things with his back, like this was about his body. We just had a scandal that was thrown in between. Now, after that, of course, we had the thing with the pills and DUI and all of that stuff. Like, okay, that's a thing. That's big. That's something that you have to like really recover from. The other stuff, man, we were just laughing because he got caught up in the worst way. Like, I feel like we have to be very careful in how we elevate the different things that have happened on the Tiger Woods timeline. But then came this win. And of course, Tiger Woods is back. We saw it from everywhere, right? Tiger Woods is back. No, he's not. Like, no. And that's not, to say that he is back is to underestimate what he was before, or where he was before, or what he had done before. This is not Tiger Woods being back. Like, I don't even know what's fair to say as far as back comes for Tiger Woods, right? Like, what counts as being back? 4 majors in a row? Okay, that's unrealistic. Like, even Tiger was exceeding the Tiger standard at that point. A couple majors a year, that feels unfair to ask for, but that's the kind of thing that like legitimately counts as Tiger Woods being back. Tiger having a nice run, not so much. Now, if Tiger comes out here after this tour championship and then he wins, say, the Masters, okay, I'm with you. That would be something to say Tiger Woods is back, and for what it's worth, it would be a time period that spanned 6-7 months or something like that. Then I feel like we could be talking about Tiger Woods being back. We don't need him to be back. What we got this weekend, honestly, was what I thought was the only thing that we could ever ask for, which is one hell of a weekend.
People were foaming at the mouth.
Yes.
For Tiger to be back.
They were ready. They needed it. They needed it. You know why? Because they need to legitimize something. In the end, it's not about whether Tiger's back. We back. Right? Is Tiger back? I don't know, but we are. And since we're back, we need to say that he is back so that we can feel better about the fact that he is back.
This is the first time I've seen that Tiger tracker on Twitter, like that Twitter account.
Yeah.
In how long?
Oh, see, I religiously follow the Tiger tracker. But even when it's bad. Even when it's bad, because that guy, he even riding with it, man. Like, whoever he is, because he's managed to keep his identity secret for all these years.
Uh-huh.
Whoever that is, good for him. Because this has been his job for the longest. Like, that's how big Tiger was. Even as it was bad, no one was ever like, hey, we don't need to run the Tiger tracker anymore. Yes, you do. Because any glimmer of hope, we were going to be there. And they were out there at East Lake, Jack. You see, all those people that were following him to every hole. Like, We need to be happy before we talk about anything else about the fact that we got this. Because I watched the Saturday round. Did you watch the Saturday round?
No, I didn't.
Dude, what was it? 6 birdies in the first 7 holes, I think was what it was. And it was like, oh, wait a minute. Okay. That was one that felt like, oh, okay, maybe he's back. Because he just dominated the course, right? From the back 9 on Saturday through Sunday, he wasn't great, right? But that front 9 on that day, that was like, oh, okay. I think he shot something like a 29 or a 30 on the front 9. And that's what was like, oh, okay, he's back. But it doesn't matter if he's back. Here we are. Here it is. It has happened. We got the great weekend out of him. Now, are we going to be so greedy that it's not good enough for us because it was a major championship? Right? Because this was, in effect, a major championship. I mean, here, this is maybe the other way that I put it about what the difference is between Tiger Woods and everybody else. I looked up at the leaderboard on Saturday at one point. You know who was last? Phil Mickelson. He was last. Now, throughout this era of Tiger Woods, we would say that Phil was the number 2 guy, right? Phil Mickelson has not played well recently. Right. Maybe somebody that follows golf closer than I do could pull up some great feats of Phil Mickelson. But every time I look up, Phil Mickelson's looking like most golfers at his age look when they're in major championships and stuff at this point. He's just another dude that's out there. And he made it to this one and he was in butt naked last at that point where I looked up. None of us are like, man, I wonder if, you know, is Phil back? You know, you think that Phil can bring this thing back around? No, because we don't care about Phil Mickelson in that way. And he's number 2. Right? Like, it's not like we're going way down the line in order to get a guy that we have some concern about. No, he's number 2. We don't care. Doesn't matter at all. He's in last. Doesn't matter. Now, I tell you who I bet cares about the fact that he was in last. Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods probably out there. Hey, where's Phil? Oh, that's funny. For a shizzle. And then go on about his business. Like that. That's where it is. But man, it was fun. And it is entirely on the strength of how good he is at this stuff. Look, man, we don't like Tiger Woods. Like his person, generally. And I'm not saying that to say that we dislike Tiger Woods. He just has never given us much to, like, grab a hold of. He hasn't given us much of, like, an insight into him. No shade to him. No beef about that fact. But I think that's an undisputable reality, that we don't have much of an insight into who Tiger Woods is. Not even after everything that went bad. We don't know much about this dude. So it's not like we're wrapping our arms around this guy that we have this great, loving affection for.
What is it about him that makes him so lovable to the masses, you know, where you have, you know, people coming out of the woodwork just to hop back on the bandwagon like, oh, you know, I've been waiting years for him to be back and now he's back.
He's so good. That's all. I mean, can it come down to anything other than he is so good? Now, Nike did a good job of selling him as this, you know, if I could give the world a Coke sort of figure, right? Like, they did a great job of that and making everybody feel like they had some level of attachment to Tiger. And he's like the only golfer that people really know about or care about outside of golf world. Like, Jack Nicklaus will probably go down as having a better career than Tiger Woods. The general public does not have the attachment to Jack Nicklaus that it has to Tiger Woods. It never has. There hasn't been anybody that's come back since that we've come close to having a legitimate personal attachment to, especially if you don't follow golf, right? Like, if you follow golf, you know all the little personalities. But if you follow anything, I once went to a bass fishing tournament that I was covering for ESPN.com, and everybody had their favorite bass fisherman or angler. They're very particular about that term. They like to be called anglers.
I didn't know
about
this.
Yeah, no, that was wild, man, because, like, they were doing the weigh-in.
Okay.
And it was straight out of wrestling. Like, all of it was like the light show and everything like that. And the music they were playing out of it. It was very wrestling-like, in their setup. But you know, people who follow anything are going to have their guys that they like. Like Ricky Fowler out there dressing like Pimpin' Ricky. You know, you're going to have some people that's down with that. You know, you're going to have a guy that you like. That's going to happen. Tiger's there for everybody. Like, the thing I always point out, when you look at the things those other cats are endorsing, like Phil Mickelson's out there with the KPMG hat. And for people who don't know, that is an accounting firm. Right? Tiger ain't selling accounting firms. Tiger's selling stuff that regular people buy. Golfers are typically selling things that rich people buy. Like, what sustains golf on television, these big ratings are cool for everybody. But in the end, the people that are looking to advertise in golf are, like, people selling stuff to rich folks. Watch companies, banks, accounting firms, stuff like that. Like, that's what the sale is. Tiger is the first person you can sell this stuff to everybody. Like, maybe if Arnold Palmer played now, because he was kind of seen as the everyman golfer of the time.
I was just going to say that people probably have more attachment to the Arnold Palmer
yes.
than Arnold Palmer.
Yeah, but at of his time, He was the he was the everyman.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that was the thing. He was their guy on that one. But like even me, I mean, I got all kinds of disagreements that I'd have with Tiger Woods and stuff like that. But man, once that thing is flying, it's like, okay, cool. We can go ahead and watch this. Yeah, I can do this. Like people who don't play golf, and I don't think that people who don't play golf have a great idea of how crazy it is, the things that the guys who do play golf are capable of doing. Like what some of these things are that they are pulling off. There's no way. Like it's no shade to you if you don't get it, but there's no way to appreciate like the difference between playing on those courses versus the courses that most people play at. And then there are the people who do play at those courses and then get a chance to go play at one of these, and they know what it is to shoot like a 65 at one of these. And they're like, oh my God, like this is crazy. This is absurd. Tiger bridges all of that, where if you don't know a thing about golf, you know this is nuts. Like, you know that this is exhilarating to watch. And everybody likes to be close to greatness, man. That I think is what it comes down to, is people want to be close to greatness. So a guy like Jordan Spieth, for example, as good as he is, man, it doesn't feel the same, right? Rory McIlroy, as good as he is, and he has a real live personality and like winds up in tabloids and stuff like that, it doesn't feel that way anymore. You know, it just doesn't, you don't get that feeling when it's on. When Tiger's on, it feels like something to everybody that's anywhere near it. And that's what we got for the weekend. Like, it was right there. That's what we got. Tiger didn't get that $10 million, though. Didn't Justin Rose did just enough to get that $10 million check for the FedEx Championship. He went and got that. How rich you got to be Tiger Woods to be like, oh, wow, I guess I missed out on $10 million.
Yeah. I'm having a down year this year, but it's not really going to hurt my bottom line.
He probably needs that $10 million more than I do. That's where Tiger's probably like, you know, he's probably got kids and stuff. You know, they'd like to go to private school also. Allow this gentleman to have his $10 million. And hey, man, then he had it. I always love when there's a tournament at East Lake. This is where I teach you guys a little something about Atlanta if you don't know anything about Atlanta. So, Gabe, do you know the story of that area and that golf course?
No, I do not.
So that's like Bobby Jones' home course over there. Now, one interesting thing that happens in Atlanta is things that used to be, well, all right, so this is the example I give. This is one cemetery that a lot of the old Confederate generals are buried in, right? Like it's that's the cemetery for those folks. Man, if them generals woke up and looked around at that neighborhood and saw what it had become, they would be mortified. They would be filing a petition to try to find somewhere else for them to be buried, because the neighborhood don't look like it did when they put them in the ground. East Lake had turned into one of those things, right? It's in East Atlanta, not too far from Decatur. And in the 1970s, they built a housing project over there called East Lake Meadows. And I did some research about it this weekend. Apparently, as soon as they built East Lake Meadows, it was understood that this is going to be a problem. Like, they just did not put enough social services in the development and around it to sustain what they were doing, right? Within 1 year, they were having meetings like, yo, what the hell is going on over here? And so someone in one of the meetings said, after hearing the description of the place, said, it sounds like you got a little Vietnam over there, to which the response was, I think it's full grown. Right. So it is known. It was known in Atlanta as Vietnam for the longest. Let me tell you what is not very attractive to people who are holding golf tournaments. Housing projects called Vietnam on the route to get there. So the course had kind of fallen out of favor as being a place. And again, it's a course associated with Bobby Jones, right? Well, eventually they got the bright idea to get that project out of there. They went to most of the projects in Atlanta, they torn down. They went to mixed income situations. So East Lake Meadows went down and the Villages of East Lake replaced it. And then gradually the neighborhood kind of, like I said, as soon as the project went, everything changed. But gradually the place built back up, and then it became a place where you could have these tournaments again. And now you'd have no idea that this has happened. Like, I think they tore down East Lake Meadows 20-some years ago. So you'd have no idea that it had ever happened or anything like that. So every time I look at that tournament, I'm like, oh, yeah, right down the street from Vietnam. Like that's what I want to say. Like, I want to get somebody, like, on the broadcast to be like, we're coming to you live from Vietnam. If Jim Nantz were to start a tournament on the broadcast with Good Morning Vietnam, it would be the greatest moment of anything that happened. So, like, I saw, you see the Tiger video with Big Boy?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Do we have any confirmation that Tiger knew who he was talking to?
No, I also didn't quite know what he thought he was going for with that handshake, too.
But he made it happen. He made it happen. And he called him brother. And he called him brother. I actually sent a text to Big Boy. Name drop. And it was like, you got Tiger to call you brother. That was hilarious. And I told him, I was like, hey, this is all down the street from Vietnam.
Brother.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? It's all, like, all of it. Like, there's that confluence there for, depending on what your sensibilities are, on one hand, you're like, the neighborhood's back to what it used to be. On the other hand, you're like, man, that neighborhood ain't nothing like what it once was. But we got it all. Like, we got it. It's great. We need to be happy with the fact that we got it. Because if Tiger falls off again and his back goes or whatever, what we can't do is go back to where we were and just be like, oh, he's done, right? And look, I thought it was finished. I did not think he would win another major again. I guess there's still time for that to be true, even though I don't want it to be, right? So it's possible that this is as good as it'll get. And if it is as good as it'll get, appreciate it. Wrap your arms around it. Just think of how good it was. And Tiger's so big, man, everybody else backs down for the NFL. Tiger dominated. It doesn't, like, the NFL in the face of Tiger Woods. Nope. We're good right over here. We had a great time with that man, and I just hope everybody is able to enjoy it. And also say good morning, Vietnam. All right, we'll be back to talk about some NFL stuff in just a second. But hey, these days you can practically get everything on demand. Like the right time. Listen whenever you want, when it's convenient for you. But did you know you can even get postage on demand? All you need is Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can access all the services of the post office right from your desk when it's convenient for you. Buy and print real U.S. postage for any letter or any package using your own printer. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Just click, print, mail, and you're done. With how easy it is, I don't really get why everyone doesn't do it already. Stamps.com will even send you a digital scale so you can weigh your letters and packages and print the exact amount of postage. Now, here at the right time, when we need to send you your Unblock Me t-shirts, Gabe doesn't even have to leave his house to get you squared away using Stamps.com, and you can do the same. Right now, use BOMANI for this special offer. 4-week trial includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage and type in BOMANI. That's Stamps.com. Enter BOMANI. All right, so NFL weekend was interesting. I will primarily here discuss people who either are not playing, don't really want to play, or threaten to quit playing, right? So we got three dudes, right? We got Le'Veon Bell, we got Gronk, we got Earl Thomas. They all connect in this fascinating NFL world of leverage and the scarcity of labor, all this stuff, all right? So you may have seen this. Earl Thomas, great game against the Cowboys. Earl Thomas had two interceptions in that game. Earl Thomas also, I would say, almost didn't play, except I don't think it's fair to say he almost didn't play because he was going to play, damn it, but he missed 2 days of practice. Just didn't show up. And here is why he said he did not show up.
What was going on last week? You missed a couple practices.
Yeah, I need to make sure my body's, you know, 100. And I'm investing in myself. Now, if they was investing in me, I would be out there practicing. But if I feel like anything, I don't give a damn if it's small. I got a headache. I'm not practicing.
Okay. Right? So this is the thing. Football players are supposed to be willing to run through walls and everything else. Earl Thomas is like, I ain't running through nothing till y'all pay me. Nothing. And you have to admit, he kind of has a point, right? His point is, you guys aren't investing in my future. I cannot give you all of my present because giving you all of my present detracts from what I can do in the future. And this is the thing that happens, right? And he's like, no, I'm not going to do it. I just found it amazing that he was so bold as to say it out loud, that he was so bold as to be like, no, I'm not showing up, not feeling so well today. No practice for me. I don't really need to practice. I'll be good. Who says that? And then your Pete Carroll on the other side, what Pete gonna do? Dude just went out there and got two picks and your team stinks. What's Pete going to do? Because, I mean, he just basically emasculated Pete Carroll because the coach is supposed to always be in control and you give all of this and they're asking everybody else to go out there and give all. Earl Thomas says, I am not giving all. And what Pete going to do? Nothing. He didn't practice 2 times. They said, I read something saying there was some significant fine that he had received, but he was still out there. How you feel if you're the rest of those dudes? Right?
Practice? You're talking about practice?
Hey, man. Yeah, that's where we are. But think about this, though. If you believe the stories about, like, the cultural decline of the Seahawks, they start with the idea that Russell Wilson was being treated differently than everybody else. That the defensive players felt that they had established a culture on that team and they were going to ride Russell because that's what they did. When you did poorly, we're going to ride you and make you rise up. So you start with that with Russell. And now what happens when you start dealing with these other people? Now, Russell is the quarterback. That's the most interesting part. Every quarterback winds up getting treated differently. But Earl Thomas just walked in and said, I got a different set of rules. And my set of rules say, I don't practice if I don't feel like it. Now, to be fair, there ain't too many other dudes on the team that can get away with that because most of them aren't good enough to be able to come out there and to say this. But Earl said it. And again, he's got a point. If he's trying to make future money, you got to be careful with this situation where they're going to use you up while they have you. If the Seahawks had any plan to keep an Earl Thomas would have been signed to an extension. They don't plan on it. And by the way, I don't really blame them for this. This is year 9 for Earl Thomas. Now, Gabe, is there any chance that you have seen Earl Thomas in person?
No.
No, this is the only reason I mentioned this. I was at the All-Star game 1 year. And I saw Earl in a bar. It was with Michael Smith and Earl Thomas walked up. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. Now, you know, I'm a big Texas fan. Earl is one of my favorite Texas players.
You're like, oh, what's up, Earl? What's up?
No, I was like, oh, wow, that's Earl Thomas. Like, I did not recognize him as, like, I had to listen close to who Mike said it was. He said Earl and then he said Thomas. You know, you're not really paying attention and it all comes together. I never would have thought that I was looking at a professional football player. Like, just in terms of stature, he's not very tall. He's obviously, like, in great shape and all of that, but he's not some kind of hulking specimen or anything like that. He looked like a regular dude just standing there. It's a regular dude who's played safety in the NFL for 8 going on 9 years. Can you imagine what the toll is that his body has received while playing for that team at that size, at those dimensions? That's a lot, man. That is a whole lot. And he's looking at it like, nope. Y'all are not going to use me up. There's no way in the world that you are going to use me up. And by the way, Earl Thomas, of all the players on this run that Seattle has had, he's the best one. He's a better player than Richard Sherman. He's a better player than Cam Chancellor. Better player than Michael Bennett. Better than Marshawn Lynch. Better than Russell Wilson. He is a better player than all of those dudes. And we've seen what has happened when he does not play, how much worse the defense was over the course of the last couple of years. And that's with Richard Sherman out there, for example. He's the guy that made everything go. And they're looking at you and they're like, yeah, we'll take one more year.
Yeah, I mean, you thought, like, with watching the progression of this team, yeah, if there was one guy that was going to be there at the end, and sure enough, he's the last man standing right on the defense, right? But you thought it would be him. And yep, so for them to treat him like this now.
Yeah. That's the game though, right? They're just looking at it and I don't blame them. They're like, how many more miles does this dude have on him? And the problem is, if they are given the opportunity, they will find out exactly how many more miles they have on him before they allow somebody else to pay for those miles. That is what they're going to do. And so I just can't think of a time a dude has looked back and been like, nope. Except I can think of a guy who kind of did that. He's just not playing right now. He's Le'Veon Bell. Like, the Earl Thomas situation is the Le'Veon Bell situation. Le'Veon is saying, if y'all only have me signed for 1 year, you are going to use me up in the 1 year that you have got me. I'm not showing up for any more of that than I have to. Like, I think we all presume, what, he's got to play 6 games to be vested to a free agency. So he's going to show up and he's going to play 6 games. But the logic is exactly the same. And what happens is, once you show up, you don't really have any leverage. And the culture around football is such that everybody's out there giving, quote unquote, everything they have. And since everybody's given everything they have, the greatest weapon that owners have against players is the peer pressure that comes from being part of the group. Because the peer pressure that comes from being part of a group then necessitates you look at these cats and see what they're putting up. You got to do the same thing, right? Because they're looking back at you. And I told, like, why the guys were so mad at Vontae Davis when he walked out there. They're like, yo, man, we out here losing and we out here doing everything we can. I thought we were all in this together. And so that's what everybody winds up in. That's what Le'Veon Bell wound up in when he didn't show up and they didn't realize he wasn't going to show up. And then all those cats were just out there, you know, like, I get paid this much, I get paid that much, da, da, da. They're like, yo, man, we thought you were coming. We thought you were in. Le'Veon is like, yeah, I mean, I'm in-ish. I'm in-word. I'm in-like.
Holdouts aren't anything new, right? There's precedent for this, but this feels different.
Yeah, they're retro new, right? Because they've got it set up now where it's almost impossible to hold out. Like, they put the rules in place to basically eradicate the holdout. They used to be much more prevalent than they are now. So they are not new, but I think that there's a generation that doesn't really remember them as being what they were before. We had them, like, in baseball, you had people hold. Ricky Henderson used to hold out right? Yeah. Back in the day. So like it is different now than it was then. Now with Bell, again, I think the difference was those cats were led to believe that he was going to show up, and he was like, ha ha, gotcha. And then he didn't come. Like I think that part is what made that a little bit different. But both Le'Veon and Earl Thomas are basically looking at this as like a moral hazard problem, right? So you got me for a year. You know you've got me for a year. What is there to prevent you from working toward my detriment in the course of that year? And the answer is nothing. The only thing that you could say could stop them from using you up is you standing up and saying, y'all ain't about to use me up. That's it. Otherwise, they gonna get you. And that's why Le'Veon Bell is at the house. That's why Earl Thomas is saying, no, I'm not coming to practice every day. You want me to invest in you? You need to invest in me. And it is your reminder that NFL contracts are very one-sided in that regard once your guaranteed money is paid. Once your guaranteed money is paid, they don't have any reason to hold on to you. They don't. And so what are they going to do? Why would they let you go if there was still tread on the tire if what they paid for was a tire? They don't get anything from that. It'd be different if they were going to sell the tire after. They're not going to sell the tire after. They're just going to take it off and throw it out. So they're going to try to get every bit out of that tire that they can get. In this case, though, the tire got the ability to be like, ain't no more rolling, baby. Nope, not doing that. Sorry. Can't happen. Now, this gets fun again, though, because it ties into this Rob Gronkowski story with the Patriots. Now, if you've not seen this, there was a story that came out that said that Bill Belichick tried to trade Gronk to the Lions. And the only reason the trade got stopped is that Gronk got wind of it. And then when Gronk got wind of it, he threatened to retire rather than be traded. And in fact, Gronk talked about this after the game with the Lions.
There was a report today that said you were almost traded to the Lions but threatened to retire. I just wanted to get your comments on that.
Yeah, it happened. And Brady's my quarterback. That's all. Wasn't going anywhere without Brady.
Now, for a moment, we will skip over the fact that it's interesting that Gronk even talked about this, right? The Patriots are pretty tight-lipped about this. And he was like, yeah, that's it. I'm sticking with Brady. Like, Belichick's thing is getting a little shaky over there when cats start getting, because we've seen Gronk. Gronk will put the stone wall up on you if you try to talk to him about anything important, right? Now he's like, no, I'm riding with Brady. Brady is my guy. You notice he like offered, you know, where his loyalty lies. But the only leverage that Gronk had was threatening to retire because he couldn't be traded. Now, I think that Belichick was making the right move, by the way, because Belichick is selling high on everybody. We watched him sell high on Richard Seymour. We watched him sell high on Chandler Jones. Like, we can go up and down the line that if he looks at a dude, Jamie Collins, he sold high on Jamie Collins. Like, if he looks up and he's like, nah, this is as good as it's going to get, we should probably get somebody else in here, you're going to be out of there. He has no sentimentality about these things. And with Gronk, Gronk's first year was 2010, same year as Earl Thomas. This is year 9 on a dude who's had a bunch of injuries and has had a lot of thought about maybe I don't want to do this anymore. Belichick was like, all right, it's time to sell high on Rob Gronkowski. But Gronk ain't done, right? So Gronk came back and was like, how about this? I'd rather quit. Right. So if he'd rather quit, then he can't be traded because the other team is not taking a guy that just quit. So what Belichick have to do? Just swallow it. Just swallow it. So it's funny. The way that Gronk was able to make this work was in effect with a holdout. It was just a different kind of holdout. He was going to hold all the way out. But what he did, like that was almost an NBA move. Like you could trade me there, but I'm not going. Right? Football players typically don't go there, but it was a credible threat because of everything that Gronk has dealt with physically and the reports we've had that maybe he want to go start wrestling after all of this is over. But that was a real live credible threat. And since that was a real live credible threat, he's right back here playing for the Patriots. Perhaps wishing he had retired. Is there a chance that maybe like the way things are going that maybe he wishes that he had retired? Cause he don't look so great. And part of that is because they don't have anybody to take attention away from him. But Julian Edelman ain't going to make Gronk's life that much easier. It's not going to be like, oh, man, now we got to double Julian Edelman. That's not how this thing works. Maybe if Josh Gordon is cold, then that'll make the things better. But Gronk, man, no, this doesn't look like he won necessarily, but he couldn't. He ain't let them do what they wanted. He did not let them get him out of there at that point. But the only way that he could do it, the only way he could pull it off was to withhold his labor. And in the end, I do hope that a lot of y'all that are fans get an understanding of some of these things these cats have to do in order to maintain any leverage. The only leverage they have is over their own bodies and the like basic agency. Yes, I will do this. No, I will not do this. And Le'Veon Bell, you say he's making $857,000. Like I was watching the Monday Night Football game, and people love to bring this point up. Le'Veon Bell is forfeiting $855,000 per game. James Conner makes $600,000 for his whole season. You think James Conner wants it that way? You think James Conner is like, you think that when you go tell James Conner that, James Conner's like, hell yeah, I'm the man. No, that's not what James Conner is thinking. If James Conner had any way to get out of that contract, James Conner would be out of it. Bell is just like, at these prices, it's not worth it for what they're going to ask me to do. I don't know whose place it is to judge him for that. He is not under contract. All they did was slang a franchise tender in front of him. He doesn't owe them anything. If he owed them anything, he'd be in there. He doesn't owe them a single thing, but the only leverage he's got is over his own body. And in this case, the leverage is not a matter of getting the Pittsburgh Steelers to offer him a long-term contract because they're not even allowed to do that. The leverage is I'm making a decision what wear and tear on my body is worth it for me. And the only way that he can maintain that is by saying, I'm not showing up until I want to. The only way that Earl Thomas has any means of trying to maximize his value after this season is to say, no, I'm not coming to practice. And what's going to be wild, though, is when there's a game that Earl Thomas is looking at him like, nah, I ain't playing. I got a headache. But what they going to do? What can they do? They can't do anything. They can't do it. Maybe they can trade him. And Seattle's so hell-bent on they're not going to trade him. Psh, how much you want to bet that change? Especially since they look like they stink.
Yeah.
Right, what are they playing for? How much do you think that's going to change? Like, I don't understand why the Falcons aren't on the phone with them right now. I don't understand why the Cowboys aren't on the phone with them right now. Or, you know, maybe those teams could call Eric Reed. We know better than that. All right, so check this out. LeBron James did media day with the L.A. Lakers because he plays for the Lakers now. I'm not sure if you guys heard. Gabe, are you aware that LeBron plays for the Lakers now?
You know, I saw some photos from media day yesterday.
Ah.
And I was like, is that Bron? Man, he looks good.
He plays for the Lakers, man. Like, this is a wild thing to consider. He now plays for the Lakers. And here's what's interesting about this. He said that the Lakers are not close to the Warriors. He said they got a long way to go before they catch the Warriors. And this is the first time in like 10 or 11 years that we're not looking at LeBron entirely in the context of a championship. Like, even with these Cavs teams the last couple of years where they got to the finals, even if you understood those teams weren't good enough to beat the Warriors, there was still a, you know, Bron's supposed to win championships, like, sort of aspect to it. We don't have it this year. This is different. And I wonder what it's going to be like as a viewing experience for us, that we kind of get to just enjoy LeBron James. Like, we're going to watch this team build. I mean, it ain't going to be a slow build. They don't have time for a slow build. LeBron's still going to be going into his 16th year. But there's going to be a build with a team that's really interesting in that, I mean, we might need to listen to Michael Beasley. Did you hear that where Michael Beasley said something that he wishes that people would understand, that guys like Nick Young and J.R. Smith and him are guys that can help you win and not believe this prevailing narrative that is out there?
You mean mud? Misunderstood? Whatever?
Yes, that's
the new bench squad?
Yes, there's a lot of misunderstanding. That's what, but his general idea. Michael Beasley, by the way, plays for the Lakers, if you did not know this.
Oh, well, I saw another photo. You know, because it was media day yesterday, of Beasley, Rondo, Lance Stephenson, and JaVale McGee.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, that's my squad. Yes.
Hold on, no. NBA champion JaVale McGee.
Oh, yeah.
NBA champion Rajon Rondo.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
The only one of those guys that I just don't think, if you look at it, is still Michael Beasley. Like, that's the one that you look at like, okay, but that's still Michael Beasley. But to be fair to these other cats, Lance is what he is, right? Lance is all over the place. Lance has played a lot of big minutes and for, you know, that have mattered in the league. And I mean, it's been a long time since then. Like, Lance blew in LeBron's ear in what, like 2013?
Yeah, it's been a minute.
Yeah, that's 5 years ago. Like, it's been a long time since that happened. Rondo has always been a kind of difficult guy to play with, but he's aged out of that. What happened with Rondo was a young dude who wouldn't listen to nobody. Now he's not young, so he doesn't have to really listen to anybody, but young guys do listen to him. Like, I don't think he winds up being a chemistry problem now because I think he has an understanding. He had to grow in People wanted to little brother him, and he ain't got no little brother in him. Now he's grown into being big brother. And that's a role that he plays very well. McGee, now that McGee's not running the wrong way down the floor, like, it's still going to be some adventurous moments that come down with him. But when JaVale McGee was at his most ridiculous, it was when he was playing on a team that was full of ridiculous people. Like, those Wizards teams. Like, it wasn't like JaVale McGee was the one. They had him, they had Nick Young, they had Andre Blatchett, but they had a couple other people at the same time. It was like, yo, man, what the hell y'all doing? Wasn't he on the team with the Bang Bang?
I might have been right after that.
Oh, no, he was there. Crittenden. He was there. Yeah, because he went to the Nuggets after that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he was on the Bang Bang squad. Like, he was there. That was a long time ago. And look, LeBron's in charge here. LeBron, the Michael Beasley thing, LeBron's done this with Michael Beasley before. And when Michael Beasley was with Miami and with LeBron, there were no, like, Michael Beasley stories. Like, you weren't hearing about that all the time. Like, this will be a fascinating team to watch because they're also operating on the premise that not everybody has to be able to shoot threes. They got a lot of guys who are playmakers. Like, Magic said that one of the things he wanted to do was a lot of guys that could move the ball around. LeBron's a playmaker. Lance Stevenson counts as a playmaker. Rajon Rondo is a playmaker. Lonzo Ball is a playmaker.
Ingram was playing point for a little bit last year when Lonzo was out.
He was. I'm still not sold on him, but I get the feeling this is going to be a team that's going to move the ball a lot. Now, LeBron has typically been on teams where he held the ball and made the decisions about where the ball movement would go. But last year, early in the year, and you know, it got a little shakier as it went and there were injuries and stuff like this, but early in the year, the Lonzo Ball effect had hit the Lakers. Like, I saw this when it happened at UCLA also. Is that, man, Lonzo gets there, the ball moves. Like, it is contagious when you have a guy like him that the ball moves. They got a lot of guys who move the ball. This could be, like, a really fun team to watch. I don't know how good it's going to be, but this can be a really, really interesting team to watch, and we get to do it without really having to worry about whether or not they're going to win a championship.
Yeah, I mean, what's so nice about it for Lakers fans is that they can watch without the kind of pressure that was on the Cavs right when LeBron came back or went on the Heat, when Bron went down there, and it was like, they lost. They lost again. It's a streak now.
Now, next year, it's going to be like that next year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, this year, it's just kind of chill out, enjoy the moment, you know, whatever it is. Next year, nah, excuses. Ain't trying to hear them. Nobody trying to hear them. And LeBron can't play forever. Right? Like, they got 4 years of LeBron. I ain't betting on no contract extension after this one. They got 4 years. But year one, we're not going to get any sleep. We're not going to get any sleep. We're going to be league passing all the time.
League pass after dark.
Oh, man. It's going to hurt. Oh, lucky for me, my TV show don't come on at noon anymore. Woohoo! More time to watch Bron. All right, we'll be back to talk to Buzz Bissinger, author of Friday Night Lights, in just a second. But guys, have you ever had a made-to-measure suit? There's no going back after you've had a suit that's made for your body. And Indochino is the world's most exciting made-to-measure menswear company. They make suits and shirts exactly to your measurements for unparalleled fit and comfort. Guys love the wide selection of high-quality fabrics and colors to choose from and the option to personalize the details, including your lapel, the lining, the pockets, the buttons, even writing your own monogram. I've got some great shirts from them, and I love the way that they fit. And here's how it goes. You visit a stylist at our showroom or measure at home yourself and shop online at Indochino.com. Choose your design customization, submit your measurements with your choices, and relax while your suit gets professionally tailored and mailed to you in a couple of weeks. This week, my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $359 at Indochino.com when entering BOMANI at checkout. That's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit, plus shipping is free. That's Indochino.com, promo code BOMANI for any premium suit for just $359 and free shipping. It's an incredible deal for a premium made-to-measure suit. Indochino are also expanding into casual clothing. Your made-to-measure chinos will quickly become your go-to pant, pairing as easily with a suit jacket as they do with a sweater. And they'll be good any time of year for any occasion, from boardroom meetings to Sunday brunches. Indochinos at an introductory price of $79. All right, we are wrapping up the Right Time Book Club. Thanks to everyone who has joined us through the summer and into now in reading the book. The book, for those of you who want to catch up late, is Friday Night Lights by Buzz Bissinger. And Buzz has been kind enough to join us here on the right time today to talk about the book. I have largely said to people that this is as strong a study as I've seen of race in America, really, because I think it came to an eye level that was important for people to grasp, because this wasn't in these big macro terms. It was like, these are the little things that you see every day. And I imagine, was that the book that you thought that you were going to write once you got to Odessa?
Well, yeah, when you do something like this, look, Bermani, you're exactly right. And this is why the book had impact. If this was simply a nostalgic look at high school football, which is written about, 100 times, it would not have had impact. It was an eye-level view of racism. It was specific racism directed against a single black player who was treated as an animal. He was treated as a football animal. He was called the N-word. Once he got hurt, they had no use for him. That is rife in the book, as is the attitude of the town. And that's why the book took off the way it did. That's why the book is so close to 2 million copies. And that's why the book sells today. And there are other issues. There are other sociological issues that are expressed, including the fact that these kids are used up at 17, the ridiculous misplaced priorities, the amount of money that is spent on game film for the books for the English department, flying, on charter jets to away games. Get serious.
I thought, and I grew up in Texas. I grew up in more of the eastern part of the state. So, like, when I read about things like Odessa and Midland, for me, it's almost like reading about a different country. But I thought...
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Houston.
Oh, in Houston. Okay.
Yeah. So, West Texas is way far away for us.
Yeah, way far away. Although Houston had some, great teams. Houston Yates was one hell of a team. And I guess 1987 or 86, they clocked Odessa Permian in the state finals. They had a great team.
Yeah, and see, Yates is interesting because it's like in the Houston Independent School District, so race is a different variable because everybody there is black. Like everybody that's in the school. What was interesting so much to me about Odessa was not just how the football team and how race played with that, but like how that dictated the way the school district lines were drawn and everything else, because the one value they seemed to have for black people was for football.
That's exactly right. I mean, they were perceived, and they won't admit it, and I hope it's changed. Blacks were perceived in Odessa as really only being good in terms of their ability to play high school football, and that's why the lines were drawn in such a way that there was a kind of housing project on the south side of Odessa below the railroad tracks that was gerrymandered in, so Permian would get all the great, black football players. It was apparent. This is how they thought they could win, and there were a lot of athletes who were great African Americans. Everything in that town revolved around, that football team, the fandom, the emphasis on it, the racism, all of it. Everything justified the means. Kids playing hurt. Brian Chavez plays with a fracture bone in his ankle, and they purposely don't x-ray it because they know if they x-ray it and they find it, they find the chip, he can't play. Kids getting, not kids, you remember Brett Hagan?
Right.
I was a really good linebacker at Texas and played in the pros for a while. I mean, he got shot up with painkillers so many times that he developed a hole in his hip the dead skin had to be cut off every week for a year. I think people read the book, yes. Were they reminded of their high school experience? Of course. Did they identify with certain players? Whether it was Booby, whether it was Mike Winchell, whether it was Brian Chavez? Of course. But it was the hair-raising look at a team in West Texas that made this book take off.
Now, one thing about what you mentioned there, especially with like the shooting up with painkillers and everything else, is the time horizon I found to be interesting. Just the idea, and I wonder what your initial perception was when you started working on the book, the idea that we were looking at high schoolers and saying, this is as good as it's going to get. Like, that was never my reality growing up, and I never would have thought it would be that for anybody else. But that seemed to be so clear for people there, is that, like, max out the glory of being a high school football champion.
Well, look, it's only when you get in this situation that you see what you see. I mean, this was open-ended. People in Odessa obviously objected to the portrayal of Boogie Miles and racism, but, I didn't create that. That's what unfolded. But in a place like Odessa, you were not encouraged to go on to college. They didn't care about college. When Brian Chavez wanted to go to Harvard, and Harvard asked for some game tapes, the coach, who was the most precise person I ever met, sent the wrong game tapes. He sent tapes of games that he was never in. They didn't care about college. They didn't care about these kids getting ahead. They cared about one thing, winning for that season. And when you were done, you were done. And when you play in front of 15,000 to 20,000 people, and when you fly to away games by charter jet, this becomes the highlight of your life. Nothing's going to be the same. You know, they were not big, so they really had very little potential, you know, in D1. I mean, some went, but most did not. So they get Division III schools, and they're playing football, and you know, they have one-tenth of the crowd and one-tenth of the attention. And this is the danger, that when you're 17, 18 years old, you're 19, and you're nobody. No one cares.
So, like, in your experience, or I don't know how much touch that you were able to keep with the protagonists of the story, but for them, the ones that you were in touch with, what did life turn into for them, and how did they seem to feel about it?
Well, Boozer Miles just got out of prison. I visited him in prison. He's out. You know, we keep in touch. I've given him, which says nothing about me. Who cares? You know, I've tried to give him significant financial help to get out of the pit. He really understands now what happened. I believe it when he says, you know, you got to get an education. When he was at Permian, he was given the answers to the quiz the day before so he could be academically eligible. He's had a lousy life. Now, who knows what would have happened, but when you're treated as dysfunctional in high school, when you're treated as a football animal, when no one cares about you academically, you're not going to have a good road ahead. You're not. And for Booby has been haunted forever by what he could have been. And frankly, you get the exposure of the book, but then you get the exposure of the film, and it's this crazy situation where he goes to the mall and he's recognized and he doesn't have a job. And I wasn't surprised. It was tragic, but I wasn't surprised he ended up in prison, because that was the direction he was headed in. And I hope to God that he's found himself. I think he has found a good woman who takes care of him, and he seems pretty centered. But, you know, the way he was treated in high school, he didn't have a chance. Now, you know, Brian Chavez went to Harvard. He's returned to Odessa. He's a prominent attorney in town. Mike Winchell, the quarterback, has a very, very quiet private life outside of Fort Worth and plays a lot of good golf. Don Billingsley actually did the best of all of them, which was surprising because he was the Don Juan. So he's doing okay, but he recently went through a divorce. You know, Jarrett McDougal, you see it in his eyes, and I love Jarrett. He misses it so much. You know, it just crushes you. It just crushes you to see it.
Were you surprised that Chavez came back to Odessa? Because I find that people tend to leave, like when they leave, especially go somewhere for Harvard, it's to get away and it's not to come back.
I agree. I was surprised, and I've thought about it. And, you know, look, you came from Houston, which is a big city. You know, you see a lot more of the world, whatever you see, when you walk out the door. These kids, I believe, had a sense of inferiority coming from a place like Odessa. You know, we're out there in the middle of West Texas. Everyone thinks we're a bunch of ticks. And it was very obviously very, very hard for them to leave the womb of Odessa. And that was true of Brian. That was very, very close to his family. And that was one reason. And his father tragically, you know, went to prison on some tax issues. And then I think it became incumbent on Brian to keep the firm alive. And his father, which is amazing, retook the bar, has passed, and is one of the greatest guys I've ever met. But it was, you know, when Mike Winter was a senior, Mike was really smart. And Mike was curious about the world. And I just urged him to, you know, he had a chance to go to Davidson, which would have been great for him. And he could have played football. I just couldn't get him to do it. I could not get him to leave the borders of Texas. And, you know, that's look. At the end of the day, it was their lives, and I think they have found comfort in the lives that they had. So you could have probably argued, you know, you never should have gotten involved in the first place. When I saw how smart Brian was and how good he was in football, forget football, he was a really bright kid, I did get involved. And my wife, who went to Harvard, got involved to encourage him to apply, and he got in. But he did go back. I thought he might be a politician or do something completely different.
Well, one place that this book helped me was where I grew up in Houston, but I went to school in a little town called Waller, which had 1,500 people at the time. And I'd never really grasped kind of the difference between my experience growing up, like my parents are college professors and stuff like that, versus the people in this town, because the town wasn't far. Like, I didn't think of it as being a different place. And then I go back for like a 20-year reunion, and I was surprised by how many people, smart or otherwise, were still there. And like, to me, it's like, yo, the city's right there. It's like 20 minutes away. And when you talk about those walls, is this helped me understand the people that I went to school with a lot better, especially with football and identity issues, because I just didn't think of anything that way. But for so many of them, this was as good as it was going to get.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, you've seen it. Your parents were college professors. I assume, you know, Bamani, you're going on to college. You ain't going to stay in high school and become a you know, high school football stud, and it has been. And you saw it. And look, I think there were some smart kids at Permian, and there are some smart kids at Permian who have gone on and done interesting things. But a wall does build. It becomes very, very insulating. And, you know, but look, you've been to West Texas. You see what it looks like. You know a place is bad when other people in Texas make fun of it. And Odessa was always sort of, you know, the heel of the state. And the one thing they had going for them was they did have, great football players.
Now, is there anything for you when you look back on the book that you might even understand better now versus about 30 years ago from when you wrote it?
You know, it's a good question. It's an interesting question. I haven't been asked that. When I wrote the book, I knew that people in Odessa would not like it. I didn't do it. There were people there I liked. I didn't do it to hurt them. But as you're writing it and as you sort of put it on paper and as you see the way that Boobie Miles was treated, as you begin to think about an 18-year-old kid, you know, compared to a horse that is turned up lame and then people laughing about it, you know, this became hair-raising. I think what I've learned, though, is, you know, people do what they're supposed to do, and it isn't fair to me to have a certain judgment that you should have done this, you should have done that. When I did the 25th anniversary, I saw all the kids again. And I should mention Ivy Christian, who's a trucker and has done great, has a very stable family and a beautiful kid. They lived the lives they wanted to lead, and they lived the lives that they should lead, and I shouldn't put my own imprint. Because, you know, they seem satisfied. There might be sadness. You can see in their eyes that some of them really miss, playing in front of 20,000 people. But, you know, this is life, and you do, I think, what you're made to do, or you're supposed to do. Back to Odessa. Frankly, no one cares about me now because of the film, not really the TV show. They don't care about that. And I have friends there. Brian Chavez is a friend for life. Brian Chavez's dad, Tony, is a friend for life. Boobie will always be in my life. He could be a pain in the neck because he can get emotional and volatile, but he's in my life forever. And all those kids are. You know, the coach, Gary Gaines, there was friction between he and I, but I understand he is early Alzheimer's, and that kills me. That just kills me. He was a good guy. You know, he did things that were wrong, I felt, but it kills me for him to have early Alzheimer's at his age, which, you know, basically in his late 60s. So it's always going to be a part of my life, and Odessa's had 30 years to pick at this book and find fault and this and that. And, you know, truth is subjective, as we all know, and they've never found a single thing. They may not like the emphasis. They keep claiming we're not racist. We don't use the N-word, and they did a school poll to prove that. And you know what, Bamani? A third of the kids said they'd use the N-word at least once a week or once a month. A third of the kids in high school. So, you know, they shot themselves in their own foot. But the only thing I regret is it's the only thing I'm known for. And that becomes hard, you know. And I sometimes think, Jesus, I became the high school literary equivalent of a quarterback. And I've done a lot of things, other things in my life that I'm proud of. But, you know, nothing will ever reach, the heights of Friday Night Lights.
I always find it interesting when you talk about the idea that people like only know you for this, because I think a lot of people, maybe myself included, I would love to be known for doing something like this. Like, my father is the founding president of the National Conference of Black Political Scientists, and like W.B. Du Bois is his hero. Like, that is his guy. And I really do look at this book as being in line with sociological studies on that level in explaining this. So What is it about people putting such a focus on this that bothers you? Is it just the idea of ignoring some of the other things that you've done?
Yeah, look, as my father said, you know, you're being a baby. You know, shut up. This is a good problem to have. And it is. But I think, you know, I wrote the book. It was the first book I wrote. I was 34 years old. I didn't really know what I was doing, except I had great passion to do this. It worked out beyond my wildest imagination. And I do think part of life, you know, is moving on and creating other goals for yourself and exceeding them. And you know, I figured out pretty early I was not ever going to exceed the success and popularity of this. And yes, at times, it has depressed me, but you know, look, as I get older, you're right. I mean, I'm lucky that, look, I think I wrote the book in 1990. So what is it, 28 years later, and we're having a discussion about it. That's amazing. That's remarkable. And I did that. I tend to be hard on myself, but you know, I'm proud that I did do that. It was a great idea, and I took a risk, and I moved to Odessa, and I quit my job, and I moved my twins down there, and you know, got married, which actually was unfortunate, but, you know, I left a mark. I left the Friday Night Lights as part of the vernacular, and you know, I did leave a mark on society and, you know, racism and overemphasis in sports, and I am proud of that.
Well, one thing I want to ask you before we let you go is that this book actually talks about two high schools, and Dallas Carter is the other one. And I remember the first time I read the book, I was not familiar with the Carter story, and it was such a jarring thing to go from all the discussions about Odessa and then go into what had happened with the guys from Carter with the robbery ring in Dallas. And I always imagined the people from Odessa getting to that part and being like, see, we were right. And that, you know, you wrote what was factual.
At that point, they weren't going to articulate that to me because, you know, they would be racist. Well, everyone, you know, every team they played in the state in the playoffs, which were predominantly white teams, you know, felt that. Now, I'm not going to excuse Dallas Carter because I will never understand why these kids did what they did, except, you know, Derek Evans, who was a great high school football player. He was great. He was better than Jesse Armstead, who went on to a great career in the pros. You know, Derek Evan signed his letter of intent with Tennessee. He was in a sauna tub with all these gold chains around his neck, and it was covered by every television station. When he got stopped for speeding by a cop, the cop recognized him and said, you know, I'm going to let you go. And when you're treated that way and you go on these recruiting sprees and you're supplied with credit cards and women, you're not going to have a normal sense of the world and your responsibility, you know, within it. So I'm not going to condone what Dallas Carter did, but there was a tragedy because I interviewed Derek and I interviewed some other kids, and they were good kids. And I interviewed the parents of two of the players, and it was crushing. This was one of the finest men you would ever meet. And to have two of his kids in prison was beyond crushing. And that game, too, went to the core of racism. I don't know if you remember the book when they were arguing over referees. Two had to be white. Right. Two had to be black. No cotton bowl. Too many blacks there. So, you know, anyway.
When you were writing the book and the decision was put in to add that, did you worry at all about how that part would be received, just because it would seem to be like confirmation bias for so many other people?
No. I mean, look, did I know that the people in Odessa would not like it? You know, of course. I mean, I've been a journalist at time for a long time. Did I have to put it in because it went right to the heart of what I had been writing about and right to the heart of how racism or race is at the root of pretty much everything we do in the world and pretty much at the root of sports? You know, I had to put it in because it did confirm many of the things I've been writing about, not just in Odessa, but kind of on a global scale, because the people of Dallas Carter were arguing right back. You know, we want black refs here. We want to play in the Cotton Bowl. We don't want to play here because, you know, it's predominantly white. I mean, race infused everything.
And they had taken a lot of the same academic shortcuts also to make sure that their players were eligible. Like, I thought that really did bring full circle that it could also sometimes be black people who are patronizing two black children and put them in positions of faith.
That's exactly. I'm really, really glad you said it because that was true. And are they the only ones? Oh, come on. Absolutely not. I mean, Odessa is the same thing with Booby, but absolutely not. The obsession to win a state championship in Texas is is just paramount. And whether you're white, you know, whether you're black, and we still see it all the time. We still see people cheating and coaches cheating, white, black, brown, or green. It doesn't matter. And, you know, what kind of lesson does it teach your kids? Well, in the case of Dallas Carter, it taught these kids to think they were invincible and could do armed robberies because the gun wasn't loaded. They weren't going to use it. But, you know, that's crazy. And they are kids. But when they're treated as gods, you know, this is what can happen. And this is what did happen.
I'll ask you one last thing about this book, just because it is the maybe the most interesting Easter egg that has developed as the years have gone on. Like, what was your thought the first time you looked on television and saw Odell Beckham Jr.?
Well, you know, that was a great, it kind of blew me away because I vividly remember the game that his father played. It may have been the most greatest football game I ever saw. And, you know, I remember Odell. I knew he went to LSU, and I kind of sort of kept tabs on him a little bit. And then all of a sudden, I started hearing about Odell Beckham Jr. And my God, you know, Odell Beckham Jr., when he has it together, is unbelievable. You know, it was the same thing, Jesse Armstead, who came back from a torn ACL at Miami. And my God, there he is, you know, playing linebacker for the Giants and playing it with the same aggressiveness and instinct that he played at Dallas Carter. And so it was cool to see, you know, look, it happens one time out of a thousand, but it was cool to see that some kids get ahead. And I remember Jesse being quoted when he tore his ACL as Booby Miles said, "I'm not going to be Booby Miles. I'm going to work and I'm going to overcome this." And he did. And, you know, I don't know him well at all, but I was proud of him. He worked his butt off to overcome a serious injury and become a great football player.
All right. That is Buzz Bissinger, the author of Friday Night Lights, helping us wrap up the Right Time Book Club. I thank you so much for taking the time to join us, man. I really, really appreciate it.
All right, Bamani, my pleasure. I love what you said, Easter egg. That was a great. I love that.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. You enjoy your day.
All right, man. Thank you.
Yes, sir. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing twice a week. Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Also, thank you to Buzz Bissinger, the author of Friday Night Lights, and thanks to all of you who did The Right Time Book Club with us. I hope you found it enjoyable. Thank you to our sponsors, Stamps.com and Indochino. My man Shannon Penn's going to join us on Thursday. Talk about a whole bunch of stuff. It should be a great time. Remember to rate us and review us. Give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to think you're a hater. Talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.